I would also like to take a moment right now to say that anybody who has any small children, we do have a babysitting, a child watching area upstairs in room 322. If you'd like to bring your children, come back. We have Mutahir and Lalgiani upstairs to watch after your kids. So there's that service available to us. At this time, I would like to invite Brother Mehdi Shirazi up to introduce our next speaker.
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
Alhamdulillah, we're very blessed to have Brother Mansour Ansari, who has been with Atlanta for quite a few years. He's a well-known activist and community participant in the Atlanta Muslim community for a while. And we're very blessed to have him here today. Just briefly, let me just mention, mashallah, he has done a lot for the sake of Islam. He is, first off, he is from a family of Lebanese immigrants. He's the grandson of Lebanese immigrants. And he reverted to the religion of Islam in 1974. He is happily married to Umm Zainab, and he has done extensive work for the Ummah. He has lived in Iran, Syria. He is affiliated with the Institute of Contemporary Islamic Thought. He's been a writer and speaker for them for quite a few years. Alhamdulillah, we are very, inshallah, we hope that his topic, historical, local, and global approaches to establishing the community, will be an insightful topic for our conference. So please join me in welcoming him with a loud salawat.
Allahumma salli ala Muhammad wa ala Muhammad.
لله الحمد لله حمدا كثيرا طيبا مباركا فيه الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد
خاتم الأنبياء والمرسلين إن الله وملائكته يصلون على النبي يا أيها الذين آمنوا صلوا عليه وسلموا تسليما
اللهم صل على محمد وعلى محمد.
My grandparents from Lebanon who came in 1890 landed in Boston. That's why I talk like this. I've been down south more than half my life, but every time I open my mouth, I get confronted and I have to show them my credentials from the Boston Red Sox. The Red Sox changed my life in a number of ways. Spiritual connection to them and the Celtics. I have to take a little bit of time, and I know I'm probably going to talk a little fast for some of you, but I want to get a lot in because this room and this building has such a history in the Muslim community of Atlanta. I converted to Islam in 74. My wife, who's African American Muslim, we're having our 42nd anniversary. We were together in Jahiliyyah before Islam, and we converted back in the early 70s to Islam. And for several years after we converted, we wondered, what's going on with this Muslim world? I mean, we're glad we have this religion, perfect belief, the status of Jesus was finally figured out properly. You know, he's not God, he's not the Son of God. You know, he had the perfect position for Jesus, alayhi salatu wasalam. You know, solved a lot of problems. But look at the Muslim world. These countries are not viable, fighting each other, even within the countries. The kings, like the medieval era of the world, kings, imagine kings. Presidents for life. Nasser was in Egypt from 52 to 70-something, then Sadat, you know what I mean? Then Sadat got rubbed, and then you got Mubarak. The same regime, 70 years. The CIA agent, Hussein of Jordan, in power for 53 years. and his little son, the cub of Hussein, again. And we Arabs have a tendency to... I'm sorry, I should introduce this. Ladies and gentlemen, brothers and sisters, respected ulama, and since it's been recorded, friends and enemies. May Allah bless all of you. So the history of this room and this building in 19... So I said, what's going on with the Muslim world? They can't even blow their nose straight without one of their ears falling off. It's everything falling apart. Then all of a sudden, like a bull out of the blue, comes the great Islamic revolution in Iran in 1979. Okay?
Now,
I'm not a real political guy, but some of you might or might not be. But this was a world-changing revolution. I had written, because I'm in journalism, I had written an article in 77, 2 years before the revolution, entitled The Shah Must Go. Talking about he's an imperialist overseer, you know, the great resources, intellectual and economic resources of Iran are at the beck and call of the big Zionists and imperialists, you know. Shah of Iran made deals with South Africa and the apartheid regime. And I said, as a Muslim, even though I'm not Persian and not even a Shiite, you understand? But as a Muslim and a human being, you have to have some faith that lets you take a position on those issues. So I wrote the article, The Shah Must Go. I didn't know that our Shiite brothers had Imam Khomeini waiting in the wings. That's a wonderful thing. But, you know, I'm not in the orbit, so I didn't know. All I'm saying, the Shah must go. Okay, then the revolution comes 2 years later. By the grace of Allah. The Shah of Iran was also technically a Shiite. But you never heard that word. Not when America was in control, taking all the resources. But when the Muslims of Iran saturated the ground with their blood, in the martyrdom of Imam Hussein's legacy. Then all of a sudden, oh, they're Shiites, they're different than you. Huh? And I was one of the founders of El Farouk Masjid right over here on 14th Street. And this room right here, and this building right here, in 1979, we were still building the masjid, we were praying our Jummah up here on the third floor. And they had a plebiscite. What's a plebiscite? They have an election. All the Iranians from all over the East Coast, east of the Mississippi, they came right here to Georgia Tech. West of the Mississippi, you guys with the gray beards, you know, the ones west of the Mississippi, they went to California, to Tehrangelis. There's so many Iranians out there in Erangelis. And they voted out there. This was the building where we had a half a mile of Iranians around the building like this. All voted 99% for Islamic Republic. Huh? How do you like them apples? And then, when Imam Khomeini, may Allah fill his grave with light, this historical figure, when he said to the Muslims of Iran, when you go to the holy places of Islam, pray next to your Sunni brothers. They didn't do that before. Pray with them. Don't be separate. Don't, you know. But also denounce the enemies of Islam. Imperialism, Zionism, and racism. And when they did that, for the first few years, the Saudi, get a little nervous here. By 1987, that's when the Mecca massacre happened, where hundreds of Iranian pilgrims and some others were massacred and mutilated by these vicious troops of the dogs of imperialism who call themselves Muhammad and Abdul Latif and all these names. And in this room, my friends and I organized. This was the Sunni-Shia, you know, debate was raging in Atlanta. And it's not a big deal, just I'm a little guy, but because I supported the revolution, they said, oh, he must be one of them. One of them. Like a collaborator with the Shiite. What do you mean collaborator? A collaborator is a dirty word. In Palestine, when you make a, if you're a Palestinian and you make a deal with the Zionists and you sell your brothers, you're a collaborator. Okay? That was a wrong word to use for me, and I got upset. And I brought Imam Abdul Ali Musa, Imam Muhammad Al-Asi, Dr. Muhammad Omar Farouk, a real Shiite kind of name, right? Muhammad Omar Farouk. and Zafar Bengash. All Sunnis, right? And we publicized the conference in this room about the Mecca massacre. To talk about it and denounce the enemy. That was the year, if you remember, when they wanted to deny the Islamic Republic for any military victory in Iran-Iraq war. So they renamed the Kuwaiti tankers with WASP names, huh? Yeah. These tankers could no longer be called Abdurrahman bin Auf or Abu Huraira. Now they're called James Fitzgerald. Okay? Just so if Iran attacked, because you know what would happen. So they massacred those Muslims making a pilgrimage because they were denouncing the enemies of Islam in the environments, in the shadows of the Kaaba, like it says in the first verses of Surah Tawbah, the ninth surah, about the Barat al-Mushrikeen. This is a message to denounce and distance yourself from the enemies of Islam. Imam Khomeini said, hey, if you can't do that in the Kaaba, where can you do it? Okay, this is the deal. So they were saying, they're talking behind our back, trying to make us isolated from the community by associating us with the Iranians. So I sat here, stood here, in 87, 23 years ago, right here. And I said, we got, what's this Sunni Shia baloney? We've got Muhammad Asi, he's a Sunni from Syrian background. We got Dr. Muhammad Omar Farouk, he's a Bengalese Sunni. We got Imam Abdullah Musa from Washington, another Sunni. We got whoever else, and then myself, and just to drag the point home, I like kind of humor. We're taping the event. I said, we're taping it, and I brought up a Sony video. I said, we've been taping it on Sony tapes. Like Sony tapes, you know. And then even on the tape itself, it said, if you know electronics, the position, normal bias. Normal bias, imagine that. And so, this is a historic room in a historic building in the Muslim community of Atlanta. Now, the topic of, and I'll never be able to do this in the time allotted, so I'm going to hit the points hard and fast and keep on moving. Not to mention that I've... Thank you. So, we have the global, local, and historical approaches to the community, the building the community. Like my brother Sankofa, Sheikh Sankofa, and Awais Khan, the topics, they, as well as the other nine. How could I be a keynote when you had nine presentations like that? But I'm going to try my best. But at least Sankofa and Khan, their topics are a weekend seminar. Okay? You've got silly people in media and academia who don't want Muslims here. See, in Islam in America before 9/11 was part of the black community. It was okay. Everything's okay, you know? But after 9/11, they changed skillfully to make Islam feel like something exotic, imported, not like America, not congruent with the landscape, intellectual, spiritual, or historical landscape of America. The biggest weapon in the room is that shiny-headed man over there, who can come with, Muslims been here since 800, before they knew what a European settler was. They were here. This is important. This is a weapon against those right-wing, ultra-conservative, fall-off-the-cliff, knuckle-dragging, backward people. We're the nicest people. We're the most cosmopolitan people. This country should look at the Muslims as a great hope for the future, and it will soon, right? We are the ones who will push this country forward to what it can be, instead of those backward, knuckle-dragging people that want to bring it back to where it used to be. If they were still in control, you still have slavery in this country.
That's right.
I'm telling you.
That's right. Absolutely.
So, I'm going to shoot right for the important point that I wanted to make. If I had a whole weekend, I would take you gradually, step by step, because we want to talk about the theory of reductionism, which is part of the parcel of Islam. I'll explain that later. But what do you want to accomplish at the end? Here it is. And you can deal with it later. If you want to go 100 years into the future, you know, Muslim thinkers and political thinkers and academics, they like to play with ideas. Myself, I'm not a scholar, but I've been hanging around scholars. I took out a lot of their trash for, you know, many decades. And I hear them talking to each other a lot. So I've kind of picked up some of that stuff myself. So where do you want to be 100 years from now? Imagine. We want to put ourselves at a tip of a funnel where eventually everything's going to have to go through there. Now, if you're a real political thinker looking into the future, eventually all the Muslims are going to get to a certain point. And what is that point? That's where I'm going to start you right now. Instead of building up to that point, I'm going to drop it now. In 1987, the same year we had that conference here, we had a big conference in London, Dr. Kareem Siddiqui, one of the premier mouthpieces of the Islamic Revolution, who passed away in 96 in South Africa, but he's one of my mentors. We had a conference, invited Muslim workers from all over the world, and came up with a big, big plan before the days of the internet. But now with the young bloods, with the internet, with thinkers, people like the people that presented before me, this could happen. And this is what should, this is where we want to be 100 years or 50 or whatever. Heck, it could be soon. When Khalil Siddiqui wrote his book, Beyond the Muslim Nation States in 1974, he predicted, by definition, what is an Islamic state. And he predicted something like that would happen after a revolution in the year 2025 or 2030. But it was just a few years later when the revolution in Iran happened, and his points were proven true. His books are a required reading for any Islamic serious work, I'm telling you. Okay, I don't want to get off the topic. This conference we produced the end result, where we want to be 100 years from now. 4 regional confederations of Islamic states. How are we going to get there? We haven't even talked about how we're going to build a community in Atlanta, the microcosm. And here I am giving you the macrocosm. But because of the theory of reductionism within the fiber of Islam, and theory of reductionism means what? If you can't achieve the whole thing, achieve part of it, right? Like if you have the hadith, if you have a date palm in your hand, and the day of judgment is at hand, still planted, even though you won't get any fruits out of that thing, it's going to take 50 or 80 years to produce, future generations will enjoy it. So still planted, that's called theory of reductionism. When you're praying and you travel, you shorten the prayer. That's reductionism. If you're really sick, you pray sitting down or lying down, or even the finger becomes the ruku, right? At that point, the tahara and the qibla and all this stuff doesn't matter. You still have to do it. Even though you can't do the whole thing, you do part of it. That's called theory of reductionism. Okay. So everything in the Ja'fari school of the 12 imams of the Ifn Ashura, every one of the imams, and I cannot speak scholarly about it, I'm sure they forgot more than I know, but every one of them had some contribution to push the envelope further toward the ultimate goal of Imam Mahdi alayhi salatu wasalam. Right? That's theory of reductionism. They couldn't do the whole thing, so they did what they could do, right? Just like we in Atlanta, we have to do what we can do. Okay. So the 4 regional confederations of Islamic states, based on culture, language, geography, and how Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala created the world. Why confederations of Islamic states? Well, we predict, like the Iranian model, that the other countries will eventually overthrow their medieval kings and rulers and presidents for life and all these dictators and all this kind of stuff and have an Islamic, you see. Even Iran, with all the... it's not a totally 150% Islamic state, right? They're working toward it. That's another theory of reductionism. Because the people who don't want to think, the people who are either too stupid or they're actually working for the imperialists, as soon as the revolution happened, this is nothing, it's not an Islamic state, they still have the river in the vein. They just dropped their blood on the ground and established everything and kicked out the Shah, but because it's not a pristine, pure 100%, you reject the whole thing out of hand? This is how they thought, this is how they think. You know what I mean? Iran, they made so many mistakes. Okay, then why don't you help it along? They had true independence. And now they're paying the price for that independence, okay? And they're sure what independence is. Okay, let's describe those 4 regional confederations of Islamic states. To cooperate for what? Economic, cultural, and political cooperation. With movement toward military cooperation. Of course, you cannot package it saying, military cooperation. No. Economic, cultural, social, you see, economic, political, moving toward military cooperation, where they can be more viable, where they can pool resources, where they can take advantage of the thousands and millions of talents. Even in this room, we got probably so many talents that should be available for the Ummah. You see what I mean? If we had power and resources, take Sankofa's position on the presence of Muslims here since 800 AD. If that was in the news, everywhere, blasting, you think these people would say, Muslims, get out? What do you mean? We were here before you. Right? Okay, the first confederation is called the Island Confederation. Bangladesh, down the east coast of India, to the Malaccan Straits, Malaysia, you see Indonesia, Brunei, Singapore, that area. That's called its island. Okay? Each one of these confederations has an economic center, in this case, Brunei. It has a population center, in this case, Indonesia, Bangladesh. In other words, okay, make it so that the people of that area can travel freely, you know what I mean, no borders, like the EU kind of idea, you know. I'm not trying to talk to the Europeans, I'm just saying that, like America, we don't have to have a visa to go from Georgia to South Carolina, right? Okay, we can do business and do that. That's one, the island one. The second one is a very interesting one. The great Islamic crescent of Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan. That's the bottom part of it. Then north into the former Soviet republics, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, Uzbekistan. This is really well thought out. This, in this case, it's a contiguous one. Imagine. It has resources, it has spiritual and all kind of human resources. One unit, even though the country's going to still have their flags and their president, you know, for a while, until they decide what you want to do. You know what I mean? Could there be one head of that whole place? But in the meantime, this is again the theory of reductionism. That's one unit, okay? All those all the stands, the republics of Central Asia, with the bottom Turkey, Iran, and Pakistan, north up into there. The third one, call it the Arabic speaking one. Egypt, Horn of Africa, Sudan, east to the whole Shebel Jazeera, the whole Arabian Peninsula, all those little oil tankers with flags hanging off them that they call countries. You know, these little, why are they countries? Because the British, over a cup of tea, decades ago, said, you know, that family, they were good for us. See that oil tanker right there? Let's put their name on that oil tanker. And they make a flag. We call them a country with a national interest. Imagine, a little country the size from here to doggone Cabbage Town. From here to Cabbage Town. And they call it a country because it's got oil. The Arabic speaking one, like I said, Egypt, Horn of Africa, Sudan, the whole Arabian Peninsula, and the Levant. What is the Levant? Of course, that's the Eastern Mediterranean, including Iraq. That Levant, 100 miles in, 500 miles up, that eastern part of the Mediterranean, that's all that part of the Arab world. Imagine one unit with one destiny, with travel going throughout. The fourth, the final one, the great Arab mother of Libya, Tunis, Jazeera, Morocco, including all of, you see, the whole entire area of what we call sub-Saharan Africa, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, Nigeria, Senegal, Senegambia. Imagine the tremendous resources that a man from Nigeria can just go up to Libya and do all kind of import, export, and imagine how the continent of Africa would just come alive amazingly. Why did these people who put this thing together? I mean, this is only a sketch I'm giving you. So anyway, I can spend the whole time on that, because we have done this for weeks. But that's where I want to see if you want to get to there. And to move incrementally toward there, we're going to have certain, you see, intellectual revolutions within the Muslim world before you have the actual overthrowing of the overseers of the imperialism, the Zionism that stunt the Muslim world. We American Muslims can play a key role in this, because we do have freedom of speech to a degree. We do have freedom of assembly, you see. We do have freedom to think. We have tremendous resources, intellectual as well as financial and human resources, to talk about and develop these things. And you know and I know that the American Muslims can have a tremendous influence over the whole Muslim world, something similar, not trying to copy the Jewish brethren, of course, but you know that the Zionist state doesn't move one inch without the input from the huge, influential, wealthy, and strong-willed Jewish American community, okay? And we're always complaining, oh, the Jews, just a couple million, oh, they run the whole world, oh, there's a Jew behind every fire hydrant. I'm not one of those kind of guys. We Muslims, all we have to do is sort out a few of these internal problems, and the sky's the limit. Now, how do you get to those internal problems? To get to the point where you can solve the problems. We have to understand the famous hadith. I remember, you know, in Islam, the Quran, it kind of comes first, right? And the hadith, very important, but it's like under the Quran, like a secondary source of guidance, right? And I remember I gave a speech on Muslim unity back in Manchester, England, in the Muslim Parliament of Great Britain, some years ago in the UK, when I was the president of Islam. What you had was a document. Well, maybe the youth can take this aboard. We had a document called the Muslim Manifesto, written by Dr. Khalim Siddiqui. In this document, it's a 40-page document, he outlined various projects and things that we've done for the Muslim community across all the ethnic and, what do you call it, cultural boundaries, even the school of thought boundaries, right, within Islam. All these things were there in that document that all the Muslims could agree. Whether you're from this group, that group, this school, that school, this country, whatever, if Muslim education was promoted, then we're all going to rise up together, right? The whole tide is going to rise. If the subject of discrimination against Muslims, like profiling or whatever, that's another topic we could all agree to work on together. Professions, in other words, you say to the guy from, you know, some Arab country, and he doesn't know anyone from Persia or anything like that. Hey, do you know any Persians? Well, not really, but there's a guy at my job. You know, at his mosque, no, there are no Persians, you see? The Pakistani guy from the Hanafi school, he doesn't know any Shiite brothers from, you know, Bahrain, you know what I mean? But on his job, or in the building, or on the third floor above him, there's a brother from Bahrain, that's right, I do know this guy. Okay. So on a professional level, outside of the actual prayer line in the mosque, then you have ways to build, you see, across these lines. And if you're from the subcontinent, and you have that understanding of the, you know, they have that group called the Diobandis, and then the Brelvis. Now, we're talking only of the, I think, the Sunnis mostly, right? Okay, among the Sunnis, I'm not talking about the Shias and Sunnis here, I'm talking only Sunnis, right? They have this group called the Diobandis. It's a city called Dioband, where they have a certain conservative, ultra-conservative, kind of Saudi, Wahhabi-oriented way of teaching, right? And the people who come out of there, they have that degree, okay? They're called Diobandis. Not to be confused with the Naqshbandis and other kind of Bandis. Anyway, we'll get to that later. Then you have the Brelvis, which is like the masses. These are like the Sufi order. They were led by a word called Pir, P-I-R, not P-E-R. For any of you who are listening to the recording, it's Pir. And that's kind of like the popular Islam. See, the Diobandi is the more formal Islam, the letter of the law, if you want to put it that way, in Jesus' terms. Whereas the Brelvis is more like the spirit of the law. You know, they want that mystical experience, right? The Sufi orders, right? Okay. They don't get along. So I'm trying to lead up to something here. I was giving a speech on Muslim unity in Manchester. Had a room, you know, full of Pakistanis from both sides. And there's most of the Muslims in England are Pakistani, like 90%, right? And I could get away with this because I'm a white man from America, you see. If one of their fellow Pakistanis said the same thing I'm going to say, they'd probably have a fist fight and bloodshed. But because, oh, Pakistan, whatever he says must be like white. He's got to be white. He's an American. So I said, you know, we've got this country over there in Pakistan where you have the on the buses that says, Ya Allah. That's very nice. And opposite that, Ya Allah, it says, Ya Muhammad. And the Diobandis, they don't like that. They have this idea, you know, real puritanical, you want to call it whatever you want to call it. Only Ya is for Allah, okay? You can only say Ya Allah. Anything other than Ya Allah is some, you know, deviation, okay? But the Brelvis, they like to go with the Ya Allah, Ya Muhammad. Okay. They don't get along, but it's there. They don't agree, but it's there. Then you got this next country over called Iran, going west. They got Ya Hussein, Ya Fatima Zahra, Ya Ali. Okay. Now, both of the first two who don't like each other, they both agree that this other one, oh man, that's way off. But then you got one more country to the west, where the holy places of Islam are. And what do they say? Besides, I'm trying to work the room, see, you know, there in Manchester. And so I said, what do the Saudis say when they get in trouble? Ya America. So it's, you know, it's a bid'ah. It's haram for you to say Ya Hussein. But it's okay for me to say Ya America, right? So you see where I'm going with this. We got this thing called the 73 sects hadith. And you see, the Quran is above the hadith. And I'm giving a speech on Muslim unity. And I quote this hadith. And the Quran says, I am your Lord, worship me. One Quran, one God, one Allah. He's the Rabbul Alameen. Fear him alone. Okay. Then you get the famous, you know, for the recruiters, the real so-called militants. These guys are not militant. If you say boo in their ear, they're going to run down. I'm a damn militant, okay? 71 sex was for the Jews. That's how the hadith goes, right? I've been playing hardball for a long time, brothers and sisters. 72 sex for the Christians, right? And then you know how it goes. 73 sex. And all of them are going to be in the hellfire except one. It's called the hadith of the sage sect, right? All the recruiters quote that hadith. All the ones who want to bring you to there, you know what I mean? Our brothers in the Tablighi Jamaat. Oh, brother, you see, the problem with the Muslims, nobody has iman. You see what I'm saying? And if we only had iman, oh, everything would be okay. So you come with us, you know what I mean? Because there's 73 sects, you know, we're the safe sect. If you come with us, we have the keys, man. Okay. Another group, Hizb al-Tahrir. Good friends now, but before they were kind of crazy. Oh, the only problem, we need the khilafah. If we just had the khilafah, it's like a baby needs milk from the mother. We need the khilafah. If we just had the khilafah, and you join us, because we're the safe, you know, the 73 sect we just told you about? We're the one that's saved, man. Imagine. They're not worried about the imperialists and Zionists and all the other peoples raping and plundering the Muslim world. They're worrying about their fellow Muslim who's in a different branch of the understanding in history. So what's the big deal? But they make a lot of fitna. Huh? The brothers in Iran before the revolution, you know, let me get a little personal here. Khomeini, may Allah fill his grave with light. He said, in the absence of the 12th Imam, we have to pave the way for him to come back. If we just do like the traditional ulama and sit on their hands and say, you know, politics is dirty.
Subhanallah, subhanallah.
Gangsters, you know. Let those gangsters do the politics. We'll just stay in the masjid. Khomeini made an observation. He said, the longer you have that position, you're delaying the comeback of the 12th Imam. If you prepare the ground, you see, and what were the Iranian people's response? Oh, Khomeini is in France, coming back from France. Oh, Khomeini, the Shah closed the airport, closed all the runways, put all kind of cement blocks on the runway. The people of Iran said, our hearts. Our hearts are the runway for your plane to land. This is serious. These are oppressed people who saw light at the end of the tunnel, who gave their lives in the women before the men gave their lives. What is it called? Black September 78, remember? Yeah. Remember all those stacks of, I thought they were doggone bags of rice. I didn't know what they were. I thought they were cement bags. No, those are the black chadors covering the bodies of the Shaheed women. This is serious. This is big boy Islam. Okay? These are oppressed people who saw something possible. And they have moved forward in spite of all the enemies of Islam. Okay? In that regard, I talked to Brother Amir Suleiman yesterday. Among other things that I do, I'm a businessman, all that stuff, but I produced a few CDs for the Muslim rappers and some compilations. But Amir Suleiman, I had a call because I said I'm going to give them one of your raps tomorrow. Very relevant. But I don't want people saying that Mansoor Ansari plagiarized Amir Suleiman, the Muslim rapper in the country, in the world. So here it goes. He's talking to someone, I don't know whether it's a man or a woman, or he says, I love you. I love you. He's saying, I love you. Okay? If I love you, how must I feel about those who want to control you, Jim Crow you, COINTELPRO you, F-16 you, crack fame you, cluster bomb you, Vietnam you, napalm you, lost and found you, lost in the rubble surround and pound you, humiliate you, debase you, erase you from your history, imitate and replace you, take you, rape you, use hip-hop to beat break you, pop lock you, Biggie and Tupac you, I love you. Just one verse, I love you. Here's where it gets really interesting. I love you. So how must I feel about those who want to assault and abuse you, hoodwink and bamboozle you, Baghdad and Fallujah you, Homeland Secure you, Patriot you, entrap you, firing line you, hogtie you, solitary confine you, Palestine you, politically imprison you, steal you, Imam Jamil you, lie to you, racially profile and follow you, Ahmadou Diallo you, Malcolm X you, Snipe you, AK you, JFK you, MLK you, I love you.
Why does it end?
Serious. If a Muslim doesn't approach social work from the mentality of the oppressed people, then you might as well have stayed in the church. I love you. Final verse. I love you. And if I love you, so how must I feel about those who want to capture you, badger you, John the Baptist you, crucify you, apartheid you, landmine you, diamond mine you, Glock you? If they don't Tupac Shakur you, then Afeni Shakur you, or Asada Shakur you, three-fifths compromise you, deaf, dumb, and blind you, cage you, Abu Ghraib you, Guantanamo Bay you, Attica and Pelican Bay you, use hip-hop to beat break you, DJ cut and crossfade you, I love you.
He's a lot.
I thought I should get to my notes for the speech now. I'm almost done. Anyway, I've given you the final place where maybe in our lifetime or in our children's lifetime, those that place to be in the four regional confederations. But that's on the macro level. Now on the micro level, every small movement toward the achievement of such a goal is a movement in the right direction and will be rewarded by Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, and you'll be admired by the sincere believers. And this idea of community building and the Muslim history, it's like oceans and oceans of study and scholarship have been on this subject for a long time. And where do you start? It's like, okay, we look at all the different authors. Now today, with the grace of Allah, we have young men and women from the Muslim ranks who are being hired and taking positions in the Islamic studies and Middle East studies and Islamic history departments of universities far and wide, here and in Europe. Whereas back in the day, in the 70s and the 60s, it was all Orientalist scholars. I mean, let's face it, nothing against... I mean, the Jewish scholars have done tremendous jobs, you know. Most of the Muslims have some relation with very... I'm from Massachusetts, okay? I'm not like one of the typical Arabs, oh, all the Jews are enemy. No, come on. Jews are usually left of center. They're more tolerant than the others. They're usually intellectual. This is, you know, we're talking MIT here, you know, Noam Chomsky, you know what I mean? Harvard, you know, people when they get a full set of teeth, you know what I mean? Those kind of Jews, I'm sure they're offended by the current right-wing warmonger image of the Jews, like Ariel Sharon and these kind of things, okay? I'm sure that real Jews, American Jews, are probably offended by that right-wing image. They wrote books that just won't quit, and others, the non-Jews, it doesn't matter, I could care less. That's the thing about America, and sometimes it doesn't matter what your religion is, okay? But there's so many authors, but, you know, like, this person is hostile, this one is scholarly, this one is fair, this one is sympathetic, this one is a Muslim, but, you know what I mean, all these qualifications, he's a Muslim, but, you know, it could be a leftist, it could be a nationalist, it could be a secularist, you know, it could be a Shia, you know what I mean? So, I mean, you got, you know, like, Dr. Sayyid Hussein Nasr, good, tremendous, one of, there's probably not three or four scholars of Islam in America on the level of Sayyid Hussein Nasr, George Washington. And his own son, very nice guy. I've made speeches with when I was visiting with President Ahmadinejad. Yes, for you recording it, that's President Ahmadinejad, who I sat with the United Nations for 2 years in a row. That's me up there in that General Assembly. And we talked about these kind of things. It's very important. Like Dr. Sayyid Hussein Nasr, his son, Vali Nasr. You see him on TV, CNN. He used to work at the, teach at the U.S. American Naval War College in California. Naval College. Now he's with Tufts University. He wrote that book, The Shia Revival. Very nice. This is not only a Muslim, but a sympathetic and a good-hearted person, and the son of a great man, huh? And he not only comes with the idea of the Shiite revival, like, you know, Iran and the Pakistanis and Shias get together over there and, you know, start fighting and stuff, and then you got the Iraqi government, which is, you know, kind of Shiite flavored. Then you got my boys, in case you're recording, the Hezbollah, my friend Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah, he and I, you know, get along real well. As a matter of fact, when I was in Beirut a couple years ago, he was sitting with one of the other leaders of the big jihad groups. And these are my friends who I've known before your government, to call them a terrorist organization. We used to, you know, have a lot of tea and watermelon together. And there was one of the, you see, Sheikh Hassan Nasrallah was sitting there on the floor. with another brother from the Palestinian movement, my close friend. When I sat down, I said to the Sheikh, Hassan Nasrallah, I said, you know, if I sit down with you, it's going to become the Sunni triangle. So we got a little kick out of that. So anyway, to give a few books, like The Venture of Islam, the three volumes set by Hodgson, these are the kind of things that the young Muslims today, if I could, you know, be so assuming just to drop a few titles on you, that if you have these in your library, you're very qualified to talk on a very high, sophisticated level, like The Venture of Islam, three volumes by Hodgson, The History of Islamic Societies by Ira Lapidus. These are books that really you should get in your library. The History of the Arab Peoples, and the other book called Arabic Thought in the Liberal Age, Liberal Age meaning 1798 to 1939, by the great, late Palestinian professor emeritus at Oxford, Albert Hourani, who, although a Palestinian Christian background, not although, he's a Palestinian Christian background, great author and great writer. He passed away just before his book hit the streets, The History of the Arab Peoples, and had some degree of commercial success, which he never enjoyed in his life. And then finally, the book called The Ottoman Centuries by Lord Kinross, K-I-N-R-O-S-S. This is important for you, the young Muslims, to develop a taste and a flavor for being able to talk about Islamic subjects from a historical point of view, because we're talking about building a community, establishing a community on a historical perspective. See, like, I'd like to get the young Muslims to once in a while be able to sit down and talk about topics like Bani Umayyah, okay, when they ruled from 660 to 750. Their state policy was, you know, just after the conquest of the first four caliphs, you know what I mean? The Arab, and then coming to this book was Islamic History, a New Interpretation by M.A. Shaban from Exeter University in England. He made some remarkable, he said, remarkable observations. During the Bani Umayyah, 660 to 750, the Arab conquerors ruled from the, or over the newly conquered people in a garrison town on the outskirts of town, did not intermingle with them, okay? And they were recognized by their dress and their whatever. Then the Abbasids come in there at 750 and make their capital in Baghdad until 1258 when they were overrun by the Mongols and all that. You gotta be able to talk about that. Maybe I'm probably the dumbest guy in the room. Some of them, I'm sure you, a lot of these guys know a lot more about this, but to be able to have a working knowledge of this, we need it with our youth to be conversant on this. That when the Abbasids came in Baghdad in 750, they changed the state policy. What happened? The Arabs who were with the Persians for 90 years by now, they felt more, you know, integrated with the conquered peoples, if you want to call them, the new Muslims. I like to call them new Muslims that are conquered people. Then the ones in Bilad Sham, you know what I mean, in Egypt. The Abbasids changed. Call it what you want, but this was wisdom, Allah knows best. This is some of the things that made Islam global, permanent, dominant, and important in the world. They changed the state policy, now mingle. See what I'm saying? And so they, you know, a lot of the nationalists from among the conquered people said, oh, we're not Arabs, you Arabized us. Even to today, you'll get a Persian guy, an Iranian, you know, nice brother and everything. Maybe doesn't support the Islamic Revolution, but they'll say stuff like against the ulama. So you know, he'll say like, oh, all of these Ruhanis are Arabized. It's not true. Islam became indigenous to them on their own terms, in their own cultural setting. But these ultra-Persians, or whether you can say ultra-Indian or ultra-Turks or ultra-whatever, even Turks are the same thing. We're not Arabs, we're Turks. You know what I mean? You hear the Persians, you know what I mean? We're not Arabs, we're Persians. Okay, very proud, very nice. But you have to understand that Islam became permanent, dominant, important, and so global, and so cosmopolitan, because of these policies that changed early in Islam and made Islam so wonderful for the whole, you know, the half of the world. When the Jews and Muslims were kicked out of Spain in 1492, after ruling Spain for 800 years, imagine, from, you know, the Umayyad period, that's when they conquered Spain. They were there for 800 years. I remember this very nice Saudi brother, they had a National Geographic article on Muslim Spain, Alhambra and all that stuff, and beautiful pictures. But the author kept on referring to the Muslims as invaders and occupiers, okay? And the Saudi brother wrote a letter the next month, very patient, very nice scholarly brother from Saudi Arabia, I forgot his name. He said, you know, let's be real here, let's do like Al Sharpton and keep it real. He said, the white European settler has been in America for 200 some years, right? He's not called a conqueror or invader or occupier.
That's right. Yeah.
The Arabs and Africans and the Muslims there in Spain were there for 800 years.
That's right.
At what point you'd be called, will you be able to earn the title of indigenous people? Or, you know what I mean? You know, they were there for 800 years, yet you elegantly call them occupiers, and you know what I mean? But you guys been here in America for just a couple hundred years, even some of you just for 30 years, and you don't consider yourself, you see, occupied. This is an important discussion. The Muslims have to be conversant with us. And the weapons that we have with Sheikh Sankofa, we need a weekend seminar to talk about, make this more publicized far and wide. We need to have businessmen with resources to make this possible for the general American public to see the treasures and the talents we have, even in this room. The small pinhead of the Muslim community in this room. And that's where I'm going to end up talking about the local. How are we going to do it locally? My example, I guess, would be what we did in England. It was a very successful project. The only thing we did wrong was Dr. Kalim Siddiqui didn't name a successor. And when he died, unfortunately, the whole thing went in the grave with him. So we don't want to make that mistake. But the idea of a representative Muslim Congress, it exists in some small level in America already, among some of the communities. You have to have a representative body that makes the talents of one individual available for the community and indeed for the country. And now with the age of internet far and wide, it could happen much easier. It can be a cyber organization at the beginning. It actually evolves into something with a brick and mortar building. But the way we did it back then, like I said, Kalim Siddiqui, he wrote the document, the Muslim Manifesto. So we need one of our ulama and one of our activists to write the document that's going to bring us together. What are the issues that we can work on, regardless of our historical, cultural, racial, school of thought, mother, whatever, all these false differences, okay? Then you come with the document. And then you, if you allow me to say, you promote, some will say you sell. No, you promote those ideas to the general Muslim community with a series of local and regional conferences. And at the very beginning, you have to kind of like ask people to serve. You know, you have like real activists, trustworthy people that you've known for a long time, that are dedicated, all the young people just starting out. You make them what you have a bicameral kind of parliament. Bicameral means what? Has two levels, two houses. Bicameral means that the lower house is what we did. That's how we did it in England. We worked beautifully, bringing together Sufi, Wahhabis, Shia, Sunni, different kind of people, women, professional women, housewife women, bankers women, you know, all kind of different people. The activists are in the lower house. That's where the rubber meets the road, where the actual quote-unquote legislation happens. And the issues of the Muslim community are discussed in an open, public forum, in a scholarly, polite way. And then you make policies, okay? Now, it's all voluntary. You're not going to rule the land. This is what they did in England. That's how we were able to get on the map, because when Kalim Siddiqui used the word Muslim Parliament, all the, you know, the Westminster Parliament people said, what? Muslim Parliament? They started screaming. They gave us about, you know, $58 million worth of free advertising for the next 3 or 4 months. We're on the front page every day. Because we had the courage to say Muslim Parliament. We couldn't have got that publicity if we paid for it. That's the lower house. What about the upper house? One of the brothers said, I think it was Mehdi Shiraz, about we need mentoring and all that, you know, for the youth and all this. Okay, what is the upper house? The upper house of the Muslim Parliament is people that come from the various professions and trades, people that are a little bit advanced in age. They're not going to do the donkey work like the young guys, right? These are the doctors, you know, come to, like you have a Muslim medical, you see, commission. Boom. You join, you're a doctor. You have like the science people, like the computer, you know, people or the internet, you know, giants. Assuming that they're successful in their trade and they want to make their abilities available for the Muslim community. They want to take a 13-year-old, you know, African-American young kid from Masjid al-Muminun behind the stadium who never has a chance to meet such people, right? Now you have to have a community that cares for those people. And you bring in these people who want to give. They're good Muslims, but they don't know who and how and, you know, how to give. Where do I put it? They usually give it to the mosque, and the mosque, you know, pays the light bill. That's it. Instead, you have professional highways to the upper house, and you bring in doctors and professionals. You bring in computer kind of people. You bring in straight-up business people, successful Muslim business men and women who want to be able to contribute. Okay, we have the Muslim, you see, commercial association, whatever you want to call it, right? Then you have other, you know, professional women's group, or maybe you dissolve it. No, the women could be doctors too, so you don't need a women's because women's are already doctors, right? Women's are accountants already. So this is how you do it locally. You have a bicameral representative body. It worked, and it did real well over there. Except, unfortunately, when he passed away, he didn't name a successor. And the whole thing kind of, you know, anyway. But I don't think we have to worry about that, because if we do it locally, this is a micro project. If it's done properly in one place, this is like Kentucky Fried Chicken here, okay? It can be duplicated anywhere where there's more than 150 Muslims. Anywhere. Small town, Yazoo City, Mississippi, or New York City. It can be done easily. If you make the document that brings us together, a few other related documents, promote those ideas to different, we'll call it intra-faith dialogue. I like that, intra-faith. It's easy for us to talk to the Yahudi and the Nasara. Oh, brother, you see, Islam, you see, is great for the women, and oh, man, liberated women, and the Arabs were burying the girls alive before Islam, and the Prophet came with a revolutionary message, you know, Tawheed and Ikhlas, and oh, we love to talk to the Jews and Christians. Oh, but I don't talk to the Shias. Oh, no. I don't want to talk to the, you know how it is. I don't want to talk to the Sufi. Oh, Wahhabi, oh, well, come on. We are hitting ourselves on our head with hammers when we talk like this. So, intra-faith dialogue. Why am I sitting here? I'm sure there are many people who know me across the way who would just be salivating. Oh, see, Mansoor talking to them, I told you he was one of them. Huh? This is big boy Islam.
That's right.
This is big boy Islam. You know? This is not child's play. Like they're trying to promote in different places. Like, you've got to be on my line, otherwise you're not one of us. This hadith, let me finish it up right here. 73 sets, what's the safe set? Until you can have in your mind enough intelligence to understand that all the Muslims that you know, whether of the four Sunni schools, the three or four Shiite schools, the other mystical schools, the Sufi and other schools, until you have enough maturity to know that every one of those Muslims is part of that safe set, then sister or brother, you don't have any business talking about Muslim unity. Because when I look at a movement, when I look at a mission statement of a group, a Muslim group, whatever, I look at that statement and say, okay, if they achieve success, is it good for the Ummah or is it bad for the Ummah? This is why they're thinking people have to, you know, that's why they guide the Muslims, right? I wish the Sunnis would have allegiance to their ulama, like the Shiites do. You guys actually honor them and obey and listen to them. And if they say yes, you say yes. But these other guys, they make fun of their ulama on the Sunni side of the scale. They laugh about them. Okay? They make fun of them. We need some intellectual revolutions. So, until you can get all the Muslims that you know, and together, regardless of the differences of culture and school of thought and language, whatever, that's the safe set. Until your mind